Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Now, to set the stage for our first panel, is going to be the EPA proposed rules on emission guidelines. Professor Snape is going to be the moderator today. Professor Snape is a fellow and practitioner in residence at American University Washington College of Law, as well as the director of adjunct faculty development. He's also the senior counsel with the Center for Biological Diversity, where he works on endangered species, public lands, and energy issues. And he presently serves on the President's Trade and Environment Policy Advisory Committee, as well as on several nonprofit boards. He's also Chairman Emeritus for Endangered Species Coalition, which has about 400 member groups. Professor Snape is the co-producer of The Hot Air Show, a podcast on climate change policy and regulation. And he's been practicing environmental law as an advocate for over 20 years. So you can tell he knows his stuff. Please join me in welcoming Professor Snape.
Well, I'm not sure I know my stuff, but I know I have some gray hairs, so that says something. This is a star-studded panel, seriously. People, and it is, as its title says, a 360-degree view of what is a historic rule, proposed rule. Actually, two rules. We're focusing on the 111D existing power plant rule, but there's been two just monumentally important proposed rules that all five of these panelists deal with on some level on a day-in, day-out basis. They're going to give us their perspectives on it. The order is going to be, first, we're going to have Ethan Shankman from EPA. Second, we're going to have Scott Shang from the Environmental Law Institute. Again, their bios are in your materials. Third will be Roger Martella with Sidley Austin. Fourth will be Ann Weeks, the Clean Air Task Force. And last, but certainly not least, WCL alum Kareem Marshall from the D.C. Department of the Environment, who will also be at our Tuesday brown bag lunch here in the Environmental Law Program. Because Professor Leiter was sick, and because we had to do a little bit of last-minute juggling, and it is a shame that she's not here. She was really looking forward to this. And not only does she, of course, teach environmental law here at the law school, her area of expertise, even beyond that, is administrative law. And I say that because I think the administrative law elements of this rule underpin some of the historic things that the administration is proposing right now, and that we're all trying to understand exactly what is happening and what we're going to say on December 1st, or by December 1st, when comments are due. Let me just let one little cat out of the bag because I can't help it. It's the professor in me, and it's not really a central issue in what I think these five experts are going to talk about, but it's a preview of sort of how high the stakes are. My prediction is that there's no way this rule can't make it to the Supreme Court, if for no other reason that this rule has an oddity with the statutory language that authorizes it, where the House and Senate had different language, and it still became law. And for those of you that remember your high school civics class, that's a problem. It's a constitutional problem, perhaps, and it's certainly an agency deference problem. So for no reason but that, I think this rule will get a Supreme Court look, and there's probably many other reasons and many other issues that eventually will be before the Supreme Court, and we'll have these experts tell us about it. But you're going to lose me. I'm going to sit over here to the side because now it gets introduced who's going to moderate, that the person who's going to moderate this panel, Chris Barrett, who is my co-producer and cohort on Hot Air. He is a lawyer with Drinkle, Biddle, and Reith. He has broad expertise in energy and climate matters. And Chris, take it away. It's you can take the seat, and I think we'll just start now with our first speaker, Ethan. So, it's all yours. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Jacqueline, and Chris. My name is Ethan Shankman. I'm Deputy General Counsel at EPA. I'm delighted to be here. Very grateful for the opportunity to be part of this discussion. So I'll start with a statement that I think we can all agree with, And that's why we're here today. The climate change is the most complex and pressing energy and environmental challenge that we've ever faced, and one that poses unique challenges for sustainability and sustainable development. This symposium could not be more timely. There's a lot going on in this space, and I wanted to help kick this panel off by just talking about giving some a little bit of a bigger picture context of some of the things that are going on. And to do that, you could just take a look at some of the headlines that we've seen just over the last several days in the last week. You may have seen late last week the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, issued its latest synthesis report, noting the severe, pervasive, and irreversible impacts of global warming. So the scientific consensus is building and continuing to grow. Around the same time, late last week, you may have seen news that EPA, along with dozens of other federal agencies, issued their climate adaptation and sustainability plans, which is just one piece of the overall strategy on climate change that's been outlined in President Obama's climate action plan. And I know we're here to talk about, mostly to talk about EPA's proposal to regulate greenhouse gas emissions or carbon pollution from power plants, but I want to pause for a second to talk about these climate adaptation plans because I think they are significant, they are interesting, and there's a lot more going on climate change these days than just the Clean Power Plan. And it also puts into perspective why it is so important that we be addressing the climate change issue. The EPA and the other agencies' climate adaptation plans recognize that climate change is no longer a distant threat. It is already today changing our communities and our ability to protect the quality of the air we breathe and the water we drink. From severe droughts and wildfires to record heat waves and damaging storms, these impacts are equally affecting federal facilities and federal programs. The EPA adaptation plan identifies priority actions that the agency will take to incorporate considerations of climate change into its programs, its policies, and its rules and operations today to ensure that they continue to be effective in light of a changing climate. And some of these commitments, just to highlight a few of them, include incorporating climate adaptation criteria in the brownfields cleanup program, including climate change criteria into the Clean Water State Revolving Funds process to ensure, and working with states on this issue, to ensure that investments in water infrastructure are resilient to changes in climate, and providing tools with the tools they need to increase their resilience in the face of a changing climate. So the EPA plan and the other adaptation plans recognize that without this kind of comprehensive effort, climate change poses threats today and challenges today to all federal agencies, including EPA's ability to fulfill their mission with respect to EPA of protecting human health and the environment. I want to mention one other recent headline that you may have seen on Monday. Just this week, EPA and the Department of Justice announced a landmark and enforcement settlement under the Clean Air Act with auto manufacturers Hyundai and Kia, based on their failure to accurately report the fuel efficiency and greenhouse gas emissions of their vehicle fleet as required by EPA's motor vehicle greenhouse gas regulations. It entailed a record $100 million penalty. That's the highest civil penalty, I believe, ever under the Clean Air Act. The total package of relief was, I think, valued at somewhere over $350 million. And the amount of emissions that were inaccurately reported was something like, was for 1.2 million cars, represented 4.75 million metric tons of greenhouse gases, which is equivalent to the emissions that would be entailed in powering more than 400,000 homes for 1 year. So it was a big deal. And I raise it because, for one thing, it shows that environmental enforcement is very important to the issue of addressing climate change. But I think it also reflects something else, and that is the important role that fuel economy, energy efficiency, and other climate change-related policies play in protecting consumers and communities and in building a more efficient, healthy, and sustainable economy. As EPA's Administrator Gina McCarthy remarked recently, clean energy isn't just about protecting public health. It's also about protecting people's pocketbooks. Clean energy means less pollution, and less pollution means lower costs to our health and economy. As temperatures and seas rise, so do insurance premiums, food bills, medical bills, and more. And taxpayers and businesses pay the price. If there's one lesson that we've learned by now, it's that real economic progress and real energy progress need never come at the price of economic growth or protecting our well-being. It comes from investing in cleaner, more efficient technologies that keep people healthy. And I think that theme is highly relevant to your work on the Sustainable Development Journal, and I think it's a theme that underlies EPA's effort in addressing carbon pollution from power plants, which I'm going to turn to right now. So, of course, a major prong of the president's multifaceted strategy for addressing climate change in his climate action plan is cutting carbon pollution, or sometimes referred to as mitigation, reducing the emissions. And EPA is taking steps to address carbon pollution from the transportation sectors, as I mentioned, to improve energy efficiency in homes, businesses, and factories, and to reduce powerful greenhouse gases like methane and HFCs. But the reason why we're here today is because among the many efforts that EPA is making is its recent proposal to address and reduce carbon emissions from the power sector. And this was a proposal that was announced by EPA in June of this year. Why the power sector? Simply because it is the largest sector in terms of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. It's responsible for about one-third of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. And so if we are going to tackle carbon pollution and try to mitigate global warming, this is a sector that needs to be addressed. All told, the goal of the plan, when states meet the goals of their plans by the year 2030, EPA's proposal would result in 30% less carbon pollution from the power sector when compared with 2005 levels. And as a co-benefit, by 2030, we would cut pollution that causes smog and soot 25% more than if we didn't have this plan in place. By the time this program is fully in place in 2030, we will have avoided up to 150,000 asthma attacks and 3,300 heart attacks, among the many other economic and public health benefits of this plan. At its most basic, the plan seeks to generate power from the cleanest available sources and then to use that power as efficiently as we can. And like many Clean Air Act programs, it relies heavily on the states to meet the carbon pollution reduction goals. And in fact, we think that is the key to why this program can be so successful. I'm going to describe very basically the contours of the proposal, but first I want to mention one other thing, and that is that before this proposal went out, the agency engaged in really an unprecedented level of public engagement. For the many months leading up to June of this year, it engaged with states, with utilities, with consumer groups, labor unions, NGOs, industry, tribes, and the general public. And it was not only because we believe in that kind of engagement and transparency, but because we wanted to learn what was actually happening out in the world, what states were already doing, what industry was already doing that was being successful, and so that we could draw on that and rely on what was already being done as the basic outlines of our plan. We heard a number of things. We heard that a reliable, affordable energy supply is vital, and that has to be one of the goals of the plan. We heard that flexibility is key, and I'm going to return to that theme a number of times, especially in terms of flexibility for states to design the way that each state thinks is most appropriate and best fits its energy mix and its policies to realize the goals in the power sector. And we also heard and understand that the power sector or that power plants are part of a large and complex interstate system That needs to be acknowledged and built into the plan. And we also heard that we need to allow for and, in fact, encourage regional solutions where states can work cooperatively with each other. Regional approaches and solutions such as the what's known as REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative among the northeastern states. So it works. So now, really briefly, sort of the outline of how the proposal works. And there's two main pieces to it. First, EPA sets and has proposed achievable, enforceable state-specific goals to cut carbon pollution per megawatt hour of electricity generated. And then it lays out a national framework that gives states the flexibility to chart their own customized path to meet their goals. So this proposal is part of a particular section. It flows from a particular section of the Clean Air Act, Section 111D, as in David, which has some particular requirements. And under those requirements, there were basically four steps that EPA took to develop the proposal. Step one, EPA had to determine what is the best system of emissions reduction, or BSER. That's the term that's used in the statute. The best system of emissions reduction, which is adequately demonstrated, taking into account a number of factors, including costs. So EPA has to determine what is the best system of emissions reduction. That's step one. Step two, EPA uses that finding of what BSER is to set state-specific goals expressed as a numeric emissions rate, pounds of carbon emitted per megawatt hour, the power-to-pollution ratio. And that's derived by applying the best system to the particular circumstances of each state. So that's step two. Step three is the states then, in turn, have the responsibility and the opportunity to develop their own plans, defining their own paths to reaching their state-specific goals by 2030. And the fourth step is that the states submit those plans to EPA for approval. And I'll talk about the timing of all that in a second. But first, I just want to go over those four steps in just a little bit more detail to sort of set the stage for today's discussion. So to figure out, so step one, BSER, best system of emissions reduction. To figure that out, and again, I'm speaking at a very high level of generality, really simplifying things. I mean, there's a lot that went into this rule, but basically EPA went out into the world to see what activities, programs, technologies, and strategies states and industry are already implementing to produce cleaner and more efficient energy. And it picked the ones that were most promising, most widely applicable, and grouped them into four categories, which are also referred to in the proposed rule as building blocks. So there are four building blocks. These are the four building blocks that make up the best system of emissions reduction. The first building block is making fossil fuel power plants run more efficiently through things like heat rate improvements for coal-fired steam generating units. And EPA determined, for example, that nationwide those heat rate improvements could increase efficiency at these kinds of power plants by about 6%. So that's building block one. Building block two is to use lower emitting fossil fuel power sources, in other words, to dispatch more from higher emitting sources, coal, to lower emitting sources, natural gas, and in particular, existing natural gas combined cycle units. EPA made an assumption in the proposal that natural gas combined cycle units overall could be used up to 70% of their capacity, which they're not all being used to that level of utilization right now. And with that assumption, came to certain conclusions about how much additional carbon pollution could be cut. The basic idea is that the more that we use these natural gas facilities, the less that we use the coal-fired facilities, the less emissions from the coal-fired power plants. So that's building block two. Building block three is expanding renewable generation, renewable energy sources, and using zero carbon emitting sources more. And that includes solar, wind, and also also nuclear power. In developing this building block, EPA recognized that not all states are the same. They don't have the same access and availability of renewable resources, and so EPA relied on different assumptions for different regions of the country and coming up with the amount of reductions that could be achievable through renewables and these other zero emitting sources. But again, the concept was the same. The more that we're able to rely on zero emitting sources like renewables and nuclear, the less energy will be produced by the higher emitting sources like the coal-fired power plants, and the fewer or the greater the reductions in carbon emissions. And finally, a fourth building block. The fourth building block is using electricity more efficiently, including through demand-side energy efficiency programs. And this is based on what's happening out there in the real world and the fact that reducing demand on power plants is a proven low-cost way to reduce their emissions, which saves consumers and businesses money and means less carbon pollution. So those are the four building blocks: heat rate, efficiency improvements at the power plants, dispatch to lower emitting natural gas sources. The third building block is zero emissions sources like renewable energy, and the fourth is energy efficiency. Altogether, EPA determined that makes up the best system of emissions reduction for the power plant sector. So step two is EPA took that analysis of best systems of emissions reduction and applied it to each state based on each state's specific fuel and energy mix and particular circumstances. It started with a picture of what was happening in 2012 in terms of each particular state's power to or pollution to power ratio, and then applied each of the building blocks to the energy mix in that state and determined what could ultimately be achieved in that state by the year 2030. And so in the proposed rule, EPA for almost all of the states, DC is actually one of the exceptions in Vermont, but almost all of the states, because they don't have affected sources that would be covered by the rule, EPA came up with a particular emissions rate, which would be the goal for that particular state. It's a complicated formula, but that's generally the concept of how EPA did it. So the third step is once this rule becomes final and effective, the states would then it would then be the state's responsibility to come up with state-specific plans to meet the state-specific goals. And here the states would have a huge amount of flexibility. EPA's proposed rule does not dictate a one-size-fits-all approach. It does not dictate what any particular state needs to do to meet the goal. The states can, if they choose, they can mirror the four building blocks. They can pick and choose from among the building blocks. They can rely more heavily on one versus another. They can go outside the building blocks. So there's a lot of flexibility in terms of how states can meet their state-specific goals. And as I mentioned before, states are encouraged to work cooperatively with each other on a regional basis. If states want to do some sort of a regional cap-and-trade mechanism like they're doing in REGI, and that's how they want to meet their goals, that's fine, and in fact, EPA encourages that. So the state-specific numeric goals and the flexibility that's built into the plan puts states in charge of choosing the cost-effective strategies that reflect their particular circumstances, energy mix, and policy objectives. It is the essence of cooperative federalism that underlies so many of the Clean Air Act's programs. So finally, I'll just end by talking a little bit about timing. EPA intends to finalize the rule by June of 2015, June of next year. As Professor Snape mentioned, the comment period closes on December 1st of this year, so a little more than a month from now. Once the rule becomes final and effective, states will have 1 year to submit their plans, with 1 or 2 year extensions possible, because the rule acknowledges that it may take longer given the complexity of the issue and the number of things states might need to do in order to formulate their plans. The plan establishes an interim goal that needs to be met over the years 2020 to 2029, and a final goal to be met in the year 2030 and thereafter. And that long time frame, 10 to 15 year time frame, again, gives states a lot of flexibility and time to integrate their state plans with existing power sector planning processes, to tap into investments that are already underway, to upgrade aging infrastructure, and to explore innovative mechanisms to meet the goal. So, again, we have about a month to go before the comment period closes, but we've already passed the 1 million mark in terms of the number of comments we've received. The pre-proposal outreach was unprecedented. The post-proposal amount of public engagement and outreach has also been unprecedented. For example, this past summer we held 4 public hearings in which we heard from more than 1,300 speakers over a number of days, and again, we have over 1 million comments so far, and that tally is growing. So at the end of the day, we wanted to put in place a clean power plan for the power sector that maximizes flexibilities, achieves meaningful emissions reductions, continues our tradition of affordable, reliable energy, is responsive to public input, is legally sound, and moves us closer to a world that is as safe, healthy, and vibrant as the one we inherited. So with that, I will end. Thank you.
Scott?
Great. Mm-hmm.
There we go. Oh, thank you. I'm Scott Shang with the Environmental Law Institute, and being from ELI, the first thing I have to say is sign up to be a member if you're not already. Being students, it's free, and you get a weekly email that lets you know about things that are going on in the area of environmental law, and not to be lost on the audience, a weekly announcement of job openings. So please do sign up and take advantage of that. And also let us know about events you're doing, because we'll let other people know as well if the event is free and open to the public. Also, being from the Environmental Law Institute, I'm in a little bit of a different position from the other panelists up here, and the ELI won't be commenting on the proposed rules, and we won't take positions on any legislation, regulations, or court cases. What we do look at is how environmental law works and whether it's serving its purpose of, in our view, creating a sustainable environment, healthy economies, and vibrant communities. So it's from that view that I really want to address 111D today by pointing out the lessons about environmental law that we can draw from 111D using the meme of what matters. So what matters in reducing greenhouse gas emissions? The tool you use to achieve your objectives, the priorities you set, the law, people, and resources matter, and the interplay between branches of government matters. So let's go through all that in the context of 111D. The choice of tool matters. The tool you use can make a job really easy or really difficult, and sometimes the tools you have at hand aren't particularly well suited to the job you have to do. There are a number of legal tools available to mitigate climate change. Creating new legislation is a really great idea. It was tried and it hasn't succeeded, but it hasn't succeeded yet. It takes many years, not many months, to craft legislation about environmental issues, particularly when they reach as deeply as climate change does into our economy and society. I'm not willing to say that legislative efforts on climate have failed, but we as a body politic are not ready for legislation yet, and so that means we don't have this tool at hand today. Using existing legislation is another tool you have, and that's the one that we'll be talking about here today. Not only Clean Air Act 111D, but as Ethan mentioned, there's a lot of other efforts, not only under the Clean Air Act, but other statutes as well. Litigation is another tool you can use. You can use theories of tort, nuisance, and public trust doctrine. Those are also being used today, and I'm sure you've heard about them. Some have not been very successful, and some are still ongoing. Finally, there are grassroots efforts. If you can't use the law, you can get states to act, which they have done. You can get corporations to act by asking them to set their own internal standards, and they can discipline their suppliers. That's also happening. And people can also act through their own personal choices. So if you really want to tackle greenhouse gas emissions, there are a bunch of potential tools in your toolkit, and 111D is only one of them. The number two issue is that priorities matter. Why has President Obama put most of EPA's efforts to limit greenhouse gas emissions towards vehicles and power plants? Some people said it's because he wants everybody to drive a Prius and he hates coal. But as Ethan suggested, it's more likely because electricity accounts for 32% of our nationwide emissions, and transportation is the other 28. In those two sectors, you get 60% of the emissions. What are the other source categories? Well, industry is 20%, but it's atomized. You have to arguably go through and regulate each one of those industries separately. That's a big task. Agriculture is another 10%. Well, that's touching the third rail of American politics by regulating the farmers. So the administration picked these things because it's where the emissions are. They also picked 111D to use this, and it's important to understand where 111D fits not only in domestic politics but international politics. One reason the administration is doing this is because the U.S. needs to be able to lead internationally. It's about putting the U.S. putting forward a viable plan for reducing greenhouse gas emissions on the U.N. table so other countries believe the U.S. will move forward in the face of new legislation not being an option. Third issue is that law matters. Section 111D was not passed with the notion that it would be used to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. It was promulgated to plug a gap in the statute that existed between other provisions, and I think other folks will probably talk about that some. Enterprising lawyers have undertaken to use 111 in a way that may not be elegant, but they hope will constrain greenhouse gas emissions. Repurposing a statute for an unseen use is tricky, and the 111D rule, bears the scars of that very difficult path. There are real questions about whether 111D can be used to address greenhouse gas emissions outside the fence lines of power plants. You heard Ethan talk about the four buckets. Well, the first one was within the power plant. The second one was kind of arguably within the power plant fence lines. The other three clearly are outside the fence line. So the Clean Air Act usually applies to sources, not to an entire energy system. So we're doing something a little differently here. So there's a real question of whether you can do that. There's also a question of whether we even know what Clean Air Act 111D says, because the provision that came out of the House and the provision that came out of the Senate were never put together in the conference committee. So when the law passed, it literally says two different things. So how do you deal with that? And Ethan also mentioned that. So there's a lot we'll hear today stems from this struggle, which is a real one and an important one, about how malleable statutes are and how malleable they should be. How much discretion should an agency have in interpreting an unclear statute? How far can the executive branch act without clear power from the legislature? How closely should the courts police the agencies in that context? And what are the political limits of these questions and actions? All of these are critical in our 111D context. Fourth is that people matter. My boss, John Cruden, is fond of saying people matter, and he's right. If you're looking at the regulatory landscape, who is doing what is critical. It shouldn't be lost on us that the current head of EPA is Gina McCarthy, who, before being picked to head EPA, led EPA's air office and these greenhouse gas initiatives we're talking about today. Before that, she led the Massachusetts EPA, and Massachusetts was a cornerstone of REGGIE, as we heard. She also is terrific at working with people across the aisle and with environmental and industry groups alike. The mantra of people matter continues to the many talented people at EPA and the other agencies who are working on this rule. But the notion that people matter really goes well beyond the agency. In this case, it goes to the environmental law and policy profession that you guys are thinking about joining. 111D is what it is in terms of the rulemaking, because people from industry, environmental groups, states, the Hill, and many stakeholders were involved in the discussions that Ethan mentioned long before the proposed rule even took shape. It's having this group of individuals, exemplified by my neighbors up here, getting together and talking about things that they deeply care about, things that will affect our economy and our society, regardless of their political stripe or current climate, to try to make something work. They may argue together, may argue with each other in court and disagree, but together they work together to help craft solutions that are meant to work, and I hope you guys can join them. Fifth is that resources matter. This 111D proposed rule is not your father's Oldsmobile, which is an old saying from people in my generation. For your generation, it's the Tesla of rulemakings. EPA devoted enormous resources to this, huge amounts of time, money, outreach, and effort to this rulemaking that you simply don't see in other rulemakings. EPA's hard work shows, whether you agree with the outcome of it or not. This proposal demonstrates that if you give an agency resources, it can produce some technically very impressive regulations and background documents. And if you give an agency fewer resources, you will get less. John Cruden also says that if you give an agency less, it will do less, not the same with more, not the same or more, as some people claim. Six is the D.C. Circuit matters. We are very well served to have a court and a bench of judges in the D.C. Circuit who understand the Clean Air Act, who specialize in the relationships between branches of government, and who oversee implementation of our environmental statutes. Watching the D.C. Circuit handle the oral arguments in the EPA greenhouse gas cases a couple of years ago was really astonishing. Those judges knew the technical details of the Clean Air Act, and they handled them with amazing agility. Watching the Supreme Court handle oral arguments in the EPA greenhouse gases a year ago was also astonishing. The justices got the basic science wrong, they put forth half-baked theories, and they struggled with the Clean Air Act. I don't want to sit here and put down to the Supreme Court, but they themselves have admitted that they don't like environmental cases because they're very hard. So the D.C. Circuit really matters, but also obviously does the Supreme Court. And EPA shows it knows this in how it constructed the 111D proposal. It literally used building blocks that it hopes the courts will leave alone. But if the courts have problems with one or more of the blocks, the agency clearly hopes that the other blocks will be sufficient to support the overall rule. That's an important question. What will happen if the D.C. Circuit or the Supreme Court invalidates one or more parts of the 111D rule, if it knocks out the second or third block or the fourth block? Will the rule as a whole stand? And what will happen and what will be the ramifications for greenhouse gas emissions if a couple of those blocks are invalidated? Those are really important questions that at ELI we're thinking about. Number seven is that government matters. If you look back at the history of climate change regulation in the United States, it's a great study of how our government actually works and suggests where 111D may be headed down the road. You start with a citizen petition to the EPA saying to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from tailpipes. EPA says no. The Supreme Court says, take another look. The administration changes, and EPA takes another look and decides it should regulate. While all at the same time publicly it says, don't make us do this, the Clean Air Act is not a very good tool to do this. Congress at the same time is considering legislation, Waxman Markey makes it through the House, everybody gets excited, and the legislation fails. So EPA goes back and has its regulations that are sitting there and keeps on moving them forward, and it passes court review and court scrutiny by and large. And the regulations we're talking about today continue to move forward in that vein, while at the same time we're hearing the issues starting to come up in congressional races and maybe the 2016 presidential race, and the cycle continues. So all branches of the federal government are hard at work in this area and matter to the ultimate scope and form of greenhouse gas regulations. Finally, states matter. And Ethan made a good mention of this. I've said very little about them so far because, although they're the most important actors in 111D, their story really hasn't come up yet. Their part of the story hasn't come up. But really, the states are the most important. They don't just matter, but they're where 111D will work or not work when implemented. They're where all this work either reduces greenhouse gas emissions or it doesn't. The lessons we ran through above also apply in the states. Resources matter. People matter. The state's ability to interpret their own statutes matter. Some states have no more stringent than laws. So what does that mean if you're trying to implement a statute like the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act and your state legislation says you can't do anything that's more stringent than the federal government? How are you going to make that work? Getting states to work together across state boundaries and regions is also a terrific idea, which we're helping with at the Environmental Law Institute, but there's also the matter of politics. The results of the elections from Tuesday on state houses and governor's offices has an effect because people matter. If you look at the Midwest, for example, there are lots of opportunities for coal-dependent states like Indiana to partner with nuclear and renewable heavy states like Illinois to jointly implement 111D. But in the face of Tuesday's results, the likelihood that those two governors will select that tool is basically zero. So states and tools and the states and the tools they do or don't use are vital in the real prospects of 111D succeeding in an effective and cost-efficient manner. Finally, 111D is really like being in a candy store for law professors and professionals. It shows what matters in making environmental law and making environmental law work. It shows that the tools you pick and the priorities you set matter. People and resources matter, the courts and the agencies matter, and the states and the public matter. Having a strong cadre of environmental professionals across disciplines is critical, and you can help. This is a chance for you to see how you might want to matter, to see what area of the story most appeals to you, what ones you think fits your strengths, your personality, and your interests, in trying to be an environmental professional or a caring citizen who wants to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Thanks.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you very much for the honor of having the opportunity to participate in this symposium. I'm always so impressed when I get to participate in events at law schools that are largely planned by students, and those are usually the most interesting and the well-planned events because of the enthusiasm and the energy that goes into these. So it's a really big honor not only to be with you but to be with my fellow panelists to talk about these issues. So I think I'm here, if you read my bio, as kind of the token industry representative, and so you might read a couple things into that and assume I'm going to, you know, bang on the table and say, oh my gosh, this is a horrible idea, and you know, this is outrageous, and EPA must be stopped, and we shouldn't go any further. And because we are speaking to a group of law students who I imagine a lot of you are thinking about careers in environmental law, I just wanted to, Scott said people are important, and that's of course true. And I want to just take a second to make the point that, you know, things are not quite that black and white. And so I'm not going to be here saying that I think this is a horrible idea or that we shouldn't be taking action to address climate change. Quite the contrary. I've had many roles in my career, starting with the government when I showed up at the Justice Department, and Ethan was actually my boss to some extent. And we've come in now different things, working for the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, now in private practice representing companies on these issues and utilities. But also last month, I was a U.S. representative to a task force that concluded that we should be looking to human rights legal regimes to address climate change issues and control greenhouse gases. So we can represent our clients vigorously on certain positions, but also make sure that we're also being concerned about these issues as well. And all the companies and clients I represent take climate change issues very seriously. They all have policies to address greenhouse gases, but they want to see it done in a certain way. And so with that, I'm gonna focus on three things for today. I want to just maybe step back for a second and talk about legally why addressing climate change, why addressing greenhouse gases is such a more complicated thing from a legal perspective than you might think or than might be obvious, and why this has presented so many challenges for EPA, for Congress, for the courts, for international bodies. Why is this issue so much more complicated and difficult? The second is I do want to set the stage for judicial review, because ultimately what we want to talk about today is this rule and will it go into effect or not and the likelihood of that. And then the third, I do want to share with you as well my legal analysis on the rule as well. And to get to the point on that is while I truly do appreciate what EPA is doing here and recognize the importance of the policy and support fully the importance of the policy, I have tried to step back and do a real objective analysis of what I think the likelihood of success is on legal review. Some of it is because Scott asked me to at ELI, and I wrote an article on this, and I've come to the conclusion that when this gets to the Supreme Court or even in D.C. Circuit, I don't think it is going to survive judicial review in the form it's currently in, and I want to share some thinkings on that. But the first thing I want to talk about is just, to set the stage for why climate change from a legal perspective does present some of these conundrums that we're hearing about a lot. And there's three reasons for that. First of all, climate change and greenhouse gases, we call it a global challenge, but it's really true. We're not exaggerating there. Greenhouse gases, by their nature, are global pollutants. When you emit greenhouse gases, they get uniformly mixed in the atmosphere, and they cause climate change effects uniformly all across the world. So, in a hypothetical situation, let's say California is very concerned about climate change and it wants to address the impacts of greenhouse gases. In theory, California could just decide to detach itself entirely from fossil fuels. It could shut off all the lights. It could shut down greenhouse gas emissions entirely. But it would not have a significant impact on solving California's climate change issues because China, India, the rest of the United States, we would continue to emit greenhouse gases, which are uniformly mixed. They would continue to cause greenhouse gas climate change concerns. So that's the first challenge that we're facing here is when we think of environmental pollution, we think of the fact that if a smelter is causing a lead problem, you can control that smelter. It'll impact the lead in the area. But greenhouse gases are more complicated than that because of the truly global nature of that. The second challenge presented by trying to regulate greenhouse gases is the technology associated with it. This is a nexus between legal issues and technological issues. But again, if we get back to our smelter example, you can put scrubbers on the top of a smokestack. You can use different types of fuels. You can do different things to control the emissions coming out. But with greenhouse gases, we don't really have a technology today that can control greenhouse gases, can stop greenhouse gases, can prevent them from being emitted. We can debate about carbon capture and sequestration, but I'm going to assume for the moment that's not a widespread commercial technology. So the way you control greenhouse gases is not by controlling the pollution that comes out of something, it's by controlling the energy that's being utilized, and that's exactly the proposal that Ethan's been talking about. The way you address greenhouse gases is either to switch to a different type of energy that's more energy efficient or emits less greenhouse gases, or just to improve energy efficiency. So that's another challenge we have with regulating greenhouse gases, is we're not controlling pollution so much. It really becomes a regulation of energy, and you've seen some of those themes get picked up today. And then the third, and this is something that Scott focused on for good reason, is the tools we are using, and this is not EPA's fault by any means, are severely outdated to address this challenge. We're using tools that at best are 20-something years old, at worst 40 years old, in a time that they were enacted that no one anticipated climate change and greenhouse gases. And EPA has to use the tools that it has available. The Supreme Court has said that, but that doesn't make it ideal. And so to the extent we have some criticism for this approach, it's not so much directed at the fact of how they're doing it, but the fact that they have to use the tools that Congress has currently given them. I agree with Scott that it's unlikely we're going to see any congressional action on climate change, which I think everybody would like to see, even EPA would prefer to see. EPA, I think if you were to ask Joe Goffman or Ethan, I'm not going to speak for Ethan, but they would prefer Congress to be giving them new tools that would be more efficient. But in the absence of that, the president has said, we're not going to wait and we're going to take action now. But we do have concerns because of the fact these tools are not well synced up to address the greenhouse gases for the reasons I talked about. Now, the second thing I want to talk about is setting the stage for judicial review, because it'd be easy to say, you know, who's going to win this case, who's going to win or who's going to lose, but it's more complicated than that. We have to look at, as Scott talked about, the courts and the people we're going to be dealing with. And on the whole, all these factors favor EPA. When EPA walks into the D.C. Circuit, it generally is not walking in on a level playing field. It's not because of the judges, it's because of the law. The law says that the court shall defer to EPA or defer to administrative regulatory agencies unless EPA is acting in a way that's clearly inconsistent with the law or arbitrary and capricious. And the D.C. Circuit has been vigilant in enforcing those principles, and EPA has had quite a successful track record in this administration defending rules where it's had to kind of use some outdated tools in new ways, and the court has given it that deference. I don't think there's anywhere where that's more true than climate change issues. We've not seen a lot of climate change decisions. There's been three in the Supreme Court, which is relatively a lot, a couple in the D.C. Circuit, a couple in the Ninth Circuit, and a few others out there. But on the whole, the themes of the decisions we've seen is that the courts seem to be wanting to step up and give both EPA, California, other regulatory agencies as much room as possible to address climate change issues. The courts, I think, recognize the same concern, which is Congress doesn't look likely to step in, so they want to be seeming to give EPA a fair amount of leeway to use the existing tools. There was a decision from the Ninth Circuit a couple years ago, probably 18 months ago, where the Ninth Circuit said, we recognize there's concerns with this California climate change law under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, but the Commerce Clause is an archaic formalism, and we needed to be doing everything as the Ninth Circuit, as the court, to empower California to be taking steps to be addressing climate change, because it needs to be doing even more. And so that was a very obvious example of the court saying we want to be endorsing these climate change mechanisms. And we've seen similar language like that, maybe not as strong, from the D.C. Circuit, where the D.C. Circuit has said we're not going to review the science of this, we're not going to second-guess EPA on this, we're going to give EPA a lot of leeway here. So that is the stage, you know, that the cases, these rules will be reviewed upon. And so that gets me to the final point, which is the legal analysis of the rule and the likelihood of it surviving judicial review. And I step back on here. ELI and Scott had asked me several months ago to kind of do an analysis of what does the rule look like from a judicial review standpoint, and I tried to be as objective as possible to the extent I can. And the one thematic thing that came across to me was how strong this looks for EPA for the reasons I talked about, that EPA is going to courts that are going to give the agency a lot of deference on the most important issue of a generation, climate change, and the unlikelihood of any other action. And the timing of this is important, too, that this is the Obama administration's proposal. This is going to be finalized in the Obama administration, probably defended to some extent by the Obama administration. It will weigh on the court that it's unpredictable what the next administration will do, whether it's Republican or Democrat. So this may be, from the court's perspective, the best shot at having a real climate change rule in place. So I recognize that, and all that is very strong for EPA and makes this, you know, a very strong case for them. But despite that, I ultimately came to the conclusion that I think it's unlikely that, unfortunately, the way this rule is currently set up, that it will fully survive judicial review. And I presented five arguments for that. One of the arguments is one that both Professor and Scott have alluded to, that there's this odd, peculiar thing that happened that when Congress enacted this provision, the Clean Air Act, it enacted two different versions. This may be a law school exam for you because it's the kind of arcane thing that shows up on law school exams, if I remember right. But the Senate and the House passed competing versions. Under the Senate version, EPA has clear authority. Under the House version, EPA clearly does not have authority. EPA has, disregarded the House version, I would argue, entirely and given full weight to the Senate version for obvious reasons. The challenge they have there is I don't think that's the right legal standard. I think if you actually look at the case law, this is not a Chevron situation. The case law, which has come up on a handful of occasions, says you have to find a way to reconcile both. You can't ignore one entirely. So this is an area where the court may say you got to go back and take another look at this. You can't entirely disregard one of the two versions. You got to give some weight to both. And so this could be a potential for a procedural misstep that the court could send back to EPA. The second issue to think about in terms of judicial review is you've heard a lot about Section 111B and Section 111D, B as in boy, D as in dog. We haven't talked a lot about Section 111B, but these are two very related rules. One applies to new coal-fired power plants, and one effectively applies to existing coal-fired power plants. They're two sub-provisions of the same Clean Air Act provision, Section 111, and they're closely related to each other. Section 111D, if you look it up, it's a pretty simple provision, is intended to be kind of a more flexible, more limited version of Section 111B on the obvious assumption that existing facilities should be subject to less stringent regulation than new facilities. New facilities are state-of-the-art, so you're less stringent when you're addressing existing facility. And here there's a legal argument that EPA has kind of flipped these on its head, that of the 50 states, 30 of the 50 states have standards that are more stringent for existing sources than for new sources. That seems to go exactly contrary to what Congress was intending here. But EPA has also enacted two rules under the same provision of the law, Section 111B and 111D, the same section but different subsections, that are both totally ignorant of each other and inconsistent with each other. I won't go into all the details, but they're doing two entirely inconsistent things with these two different subprovisions. And this is an area of the law where courts are unlikely to give agencies deference. We know about Chevron. I've talked a lot about how much deference I think EPA will get on this. But courts are reluctant to give an agency deference when it's acting inconsistently on related provisions or related actions. So I think this is another area for vulnerability for EPA. The third area, which I think is probably the highest area of vulnerability is something Scott alluded to, which is this beyond the fence line argument. And again, to really simplify this, if this is my coal-fired power plant, up until 2014, in the history of the Clean Air Act, EPA has always applied regulations to this coal-fired power plant that focused on what this facility can do inside the fence line and what technologies can this facility implement inside the fence line of the facility. With this ESPS, for the first time, EPA is now saying, we're going to look beyond the fence line of this facility because we can only get 6% reductions inside the fence line. We want to get 30%. 6% is not enough. So we're going to go beyond, and we're going to look at this natural gas combined cycle facility over here. We're going to look at this nuclear energy facility, a renewable effort, and energy efficiency. And we're going to hold this coal-fired power plant accountable for all the reductions that can be achieved beyond the fence line. And we're also going to allow states to hold these entities liable as part of this rule for the reductions that have to be achieved by the coal-fired power plant. The challenge here, I think, for the court, and this is what I think ultimately the court will get held up on, is this is really opening an entirely new line of precedent in the history of the Clean Air Act. This is effectively, in my view, a legislative amendment to the Clean Air Act without the legislative amendment. This is EPA deciding that because we have to tackle climate change, we have to give ourselves new authority. But it goes beyond the practice. It goes beyond the legislative history. And it is the kind of thing that I think Congress could tell the EPA to do, but that EPA can't kind of bootstrap on its own authority. So as important as I think the court will pay attention to the climate change issues and give EPA deference on that, I think the court will also ultimately be concerned about the precedent of this new era of going beyond the fence line and regulation, and what that could lead to for other sectors, and finding a concern with building blocks 2, 3, and 4 because of that. And then the final thing, I'll skip some of the others of scores of arguments, is there's also been some reference during the introduction and other times today about a recent Supreme Court decision. Back in, I think it was May or June, I think it was June, the Supreme Court issued another greenhouse gas decision that didn't address the ESPS directly. It came out 4 days after the ESPS proposal. But the court said some things in there that seemed to have very significant bearing, and Justice Scalia in this 5-4 decision specifically said that the Clean Air Act does not authorize EPA to use a specific provision of the Clean Air Act to regulate entire sectors of the economy. And it wasn't talking about the ESPS. It was talking about something else called the tailoring rule, which actually was a lot more modest than the ESPS. So I think objectively anybody would have to look at this, including EPA, including the courts, and look at this language saying, well, the Supreme Court was concerned in that case about saying you can't use a provision of the Clean Air Act to regulate entire sectors of the economy on the tailoring rule. That seems to be pretty strongly on point here. And I think to make the point even further is getting back to why is it so hard to regulate greenhouse gases. You're not regulating the air pollution, you're regulating the energy. And what you hear a lot this morning and what you probably hear later today is not a whole lot of talk about controlling this from an environmental perspective, but about the energy issues, the energy consequences of it, interstate trading, working with FERC, working with public utility commissions. Like other people here, I've given probably 50 presentations on this since the rule came out, and the presentations have been almost entirely dedicated not to environmental issues but to the energy consequences of this. And on energy issues, that's an area where EPA does not get deference. It does get tremendous deference when it's talking about ozone NACs and how to set a NAC for a certain pollutant, but when it's talking about how to reconcile a greenhouse gas regulation with state energy grids, that's an area that it won't get deference. So I do think the Supreme Court will cast a shadow on this. I think it will cast a shadow not only on the future Supreme Court issues, but also on the D.C. Circuit that ultimately will review that. So that is kind of where I come out, recognizing that, you know, the importance of this and not trying to take away from the important policy that both the President and EPA are trying to achieve and why they're doing this and being sympathetic to why they're doing it, but also recognizing that there probably will be limits on this enforced by the court given the concern for precedent overall.
Anne, if you could share your views.
Certainly. I guess I'm here to give the environment the perspective that Roger was saying he doesn't usually hear in this, and that's the environmental perspective. You know, why this is important for the globe, for the climate. And I guess I'm here as the token environmental group representative, but I don't speak for the environmental community. We really are not the uniform bloc that we are sometimes made out to be. But we all do, I think, begin this conversation from the perspective that the world's climate is changing a lot faster than anything we're doing to fix the problem, and that the United States really has to do something soon, and we have to do it in meaningful ways in order to reduce emissions from the largest sources. We've been talking since 2009 about a commitment to reduce CO2 emissions, and that's just one of the greenhouse gases, full 17% below 2005 levels, and this target is by 2020. So far, we're not seeing a lot of action. And I also want to take the moral dimension. It is morally right for the United States to do something. We are a significant part of the problem. And we are among the world economies that is actually poised to make a difference. Unfortunately, we've had legislative failure here, as we've heard, and so the Clean Air Act is it. But I guess I don't share Roger's the negative view of the Clean Air Act as a flexible and potentially really rich tool to use in this. Maybe because I'm over 40, I recognize that with age comes experience and wisdom, and there's a lot of precedent, there's been a lot of positive benefit that we have marked and seen and achieved under the Clean Air Act, and I think that there's no reason why that can't occur here. That having been said, and I do want to say also that when we're talking about fossil fuel power plants, we've heard 30%, 40%. It's 40% of the anthropogenic CO2 emissions our country produces are from our fossil generation fleet. So this is a big deal. This is something that if we can get some meaningful controls in place, will make a difference. we read, meaning my office and most of the environmental community, I think I can say, the relevant section of the Act to require that after EPA has proposed standards for new sources, as it has done here, for any pollutant that is not an air toxic and not regulated in the ambient air the way some pollutants are, that the agency must also propose and finalize standards for existing sources of that pollutant in that industry. That reading of the section of the statute that we're talking about tracks the pre-1990 version of the statute, and one can only assume that that's what Congress intended because, as we know, the Supreme Court has told us, and people keep repeating, that Congress doesn't hide elephants in mouse holes. If Congress had intended to completely rework how this section works, and this section of the statute's been in place since 1970, the rules have been in place since 1975, Congress would have said so in the legislative history. It would have explained that it was changing things radically, but it didn't do that. Okay, so what about the ESPS? We at CATF think about the ESPS as being hedged by six criteria. What would a good performance standard look like for us? At the end of the day, it has to yield carbon dioxide reductions from the industry that are permanent, enforceable, and verifiable. It has to be consistent with the statutory requirement that EPA directs and states implement and enforce those standards of performance. It needs to be legally defensible. All of its elements need to hew to the statutory language to the extent that they can. It needs to be politically feasible. State implementation schemes are already out there, and EPA needs to recognize those elements of those plans that are already in place that are achieving reductions from EGUs, EGUs being the Clean Air Act short form for electric generating stations or power plants. The tool matters, as I think somebody said. The plan, the standards need to be easily and efficiently implemented, and they need to be able to be tracked by states. I think states are not going to be encouraged to move forward if this looks so complicated that when they don't have the resources to handle it. And for the task force, it's important for us that these reductions that are being requested by the agency are sufficient enough that they energize innovation, that there's an incentive for the industry to work and invest in developing new lower-emitting technologies, new retrofits for CO2 emissions. I think we're seeing, at least in Canada, retrofits on existing coal plants to capture and sequester carbon dioxide, and that the agency provides some regulatory support for that, and help the states implement systems that will, in fact, incorporate those new technologies. So does the EPA's proposed ESPS fit the bill for us? I should note that we're still working on our comments. Obviously what we say, what I'm saying here may or may not end up in our comments, but, and I don't speak, again, I don't speak for the entire environmental community. But I will say that the ESPS proposal, and it is a proposal, it's not a final rule yet, and EPA has received over, a million comments? So the agency's got some work to do in figuring out how it's going to reconcile all of the things it's hearing, and so the final rule undoubtedly will look different than the proposal. We think it could fit the bill with some tweaking. So EPA has identified the best system of emission reduction, as you heard, based on a series of building blocks applied state by state. And that describes a reasonable expectation of reductions that you can achieve from this sector. EPA has presented this in two forms. One form is based on all the building blocks taken together, which I think presents some of the problems that Roger was identifying, where EPA usually regulates what comes out of the stack and through measures that are applied at the facility, but that version of the rule spreads out beyond the facility itself. EPA has also asked for comment on an alternative formulation in which the other measures that EPA is evaluating and figuring out what can be done at the industry, all are tied back to actual reductions from sources in the industry, reduced utilization of the fossil generating fleet. Whichever metric you like to think about this way of developing them, the outcome is a series of targets by state for carbon dioxide emissions, and those targets are carbon dioxide emissions per megawatt hour. That's a rate. So one of the issues for us is that if you set a standard on a rate like this, there's no cap on it. So this is fine as far as it goes. We think EPA has a lot of discretion to figure out what those targets ought to be. We do think that the discretion that the agency has is bounded by the requirements that the best system of emission reduction has to be forward-looking and has to be technology-forcing for existing sources in the industry, just like it is for new sources. This comes out of the case law. EPA really is not supposed to use its authority to do less than it can do. So what could EPA have done better? Well, EPA could have folded in some retirements that have already occurred in these major emitters that have caused either that have already occurred sort of, so they start from a baseline of 2012 emissions, right? And then they add on what can be done through the different building blocks to get your 2030 target rate. In this 2012 number are not counted some emissions reductions that are, have either already occurred or that are definitively slated to occur through retirement of existing facilities. If you include those in the baseline, you start from a lower place. So that could have happened. EPA could have more accurately assessed the expected role of nuclear units in accounting for zero carbon energy, because unlike some of the environmental community, our organization is actually pretty positive about the idea that nuclear energy is a zero carbon emitting resource. And we think that the agency needs to recognize that too. EPA could have modeled expected carbon capture retrofits and sequestration where that's already planned and available. And so, you know, we're not without our criticisms of what has happened so far to date in the agency's proposal, what's out there. But on the whole, we can say, I think, that EPA's targets are reasonable, that they have authority to do what they've done, and that perhaps the tweaks I'm suggesting are simply demonstrations that the targets are reasonable. You can meet them in a lot of different ways. So you're not, and I'm not sure if anybody on the panel has said this before, but the states are not required to implement these building blocks. The states are required to come up with their own plans that fit their own circumstances, but that reach the targets. So, as we look at that, as we think about implementation, one of the things that we at the task force have been thinking about is the need for a firm cap on the emissions of this sector because climate pollution is a global pollutant and because if you reduce it significantly in, say, Texas, that will have an impact in Rhode Island on the coast. It, you know, when if we reduce global warming emissions and we are able to avoid the worst damage of climate change, it matters for a toxic air pollutant if you are reducing it right next to you. For a global pollutant like carbon dioxide, it doesn't matter. You can get the benefit in Rhode Island if you reduce your emissions in Texas. So that seems to us to suggest that an allowance or a mass-based allowance trading system would be a good outcome here. If EPA can figure out a way to provide incentives for states in their plans to work together. There are political issues with this, as we heard, but increasingly, as I think about this rule, I think, you know, allowance trading is the answer. What's the question? I mean, it just seems like all roads lead me there. And luckily, the EPA's longstanding, as I said, since 1975 rules specifically permit or direct or allow for allowance trading mass-based systems, which might enable the state-by-state targets to be met in that way. What EPA would need to help out with that is to provide some further guidance about how you get from the best system of emission reduction building block-based rates to a mass-based cap for your state, and how you might, you know, what makes a SIP approvable? Because, as I said, one of the criteria has to be how easy is this for the states to implement. So, finally, and in summary, I think we have an obligation to our partners, we as a country in the international community, to tackle the problem of climate change using the best tools we have. And right now, that's the Clean Air Act system of performance standards and the supporting permits. EPA's rule is a good start. We support it, particularly the alternative, as I said, that's framed in terms of measures that can achieve CO2 reductions through reduced utilization of the highest emitting sources in the fleet. And we're going to offer some comments. Another thing to think about, by the way, is that this rule relies a lot on the use of natural gas. Well, that has implications as well for global warming, since natural gas is mostly methane, and methane is a lot more potent in the early years than is carbon dioxide. So what can EPA be doing to make sure that moving toward a more methane-based, natural gas-based energy system doesn't negate the positive benefits of reducing CO2 emissions? EPA needs to think about regulating the methane emissions directly regulating the methane emissions from the oil and gas sector, which is another question before the agency. It's another issue that's right on point right now that the administrator is considering making a decision about. We need all of the tools in the quiver, not just the ESPS, not just the 111B as in boy, new source performance standards for power plants, but we also need methane regulations. We need to encourage the gas industry to plug some leaks and to stop venting and flaring methane. We think that will also go a long way toward a significant national climate policy. So that's what I have for today, and I appreciate Kareem's patience.
Thank you.
Now we're going to hear from someone who has to deal with it directly.
I need to switch this over. How do we do that? Thank you. Incidentally, this is every public speaker's worst nightmare, a technical failure. Okay, wasn't nearly as bad as I thought it would be. Good morning, or actually good afternoon. I'm here to discuss the impact of the proposed rule and the perspective of the District of Columbia as a state. As you probably know, for the purposes of the Clean Air Act, the District of Columbia is treated as a state. And within the District of Columbia, the District Department of the Environment is charged with the protection of human and environmental health in the District of Columbia. Now, we have programs that deal with all regulated media, but most relevant to this rule, we have programs that affect energy use, flood mitigation, climate adaptation, and of course, air quality. The rule's major thrust is the proposed state goals for carbon emission reduction. However, the district And this was my punchline. You stole my punchline, Ethan. The district has no regulated power plants in its borders. The districts and its residents obtain their power through PJM. PJM is the nation's oldest independent system operator. ISOs operate, but don't own transmission systems on utility grids. PJM just manages the market. They make sure that it's working. They make sure there's enough power on the grid, and they make sure that the generators are connected to the proper delivery systems. As an aside, ISOs rarely get any public coverage, and unfortunately, they only get coverage when things go wrong, like the blackout in 2003. Generation and delivery is owned and controlled by separate companies. Some may do both, some do one or the other. You'll notice that in these lists of states included in PJM, this list to the right is actually the list of emission reductions for the states under the proposed rule. You'll notice that the district actually isn't listed. And that's because we don't actually have any power plants. Now, aside from the district, Vermont is the only state that wasn't listed. Now, being the perceptive and intelligent group you are, you're asking, well, why is this relevant to the district? Why aren't we hearing from Maryland or Virginia since they actually have power plants? Now, from that perspective, and I'm glad that you asked that hypothetical question, the district imports nearly all of our energy. There are a few small producing power plants in the district. One is the Capital Power Plant, and if you want to hear some really interesting arguments, get someone who is a Republican from Congress and someone who doesn't like coal in the same room and let them talk about the Capital Power Plant. Just give them plenty of room. But because we import almost all of our energy in the district, I can tell you what the consumer end does. And that's where we're taking most of our actions, and I hope to get through that before my 10 minutes expire. The district is actually uniquely positioned to be affected by the consequences of climate change. Criteria pollutants from neighboring states very easily affect the air quality of the district. They contribute to our ozone levels and our own carbon emissions. As the nation's capital and the region's economic center, we can drive and influence energy policy, but we can't act alone. Therefore, our director, Keith Anderson, submitted testimony that advocated very strongly for the allowable carbon pollution from the power sector to be significantly reduced. Another related long-term threat is that of rising sea levels, and this is why I like this map so much. This is flood data, and we have three different types of data that's illustrated by this map, and it should actually be, it's not quite as visible as I would have liked it to be, but we have this data for the entirety of the city. But the good thing about using the federal core for these types of presentations is that people recognize this area, and it really drives home the potential influences of climate change. So before I go into the explanation of the map, I'm going to just make the link explicit. More CO2 emissions equal higher temperatures, which leads to warmer seas, which leads to less polar ice and less mountain snow, which leads to worse storms and higher sea levels, and that leads to more floods. Now, there are three colors on this map. There's a dark blue, a pink, and what I've termed periwinkle. The dark blue is what is the 100-year floodplain. Now, 100-year floodplain is a bit of a misnomer. It's not the flood that happens every 100 years. It's that every year there's a 1% chance of this flood occurring. The pink is the 500-year floodplain. Again, not every 500 years, but it's a 0.2% of that flood ever occurring every single year. Now, we know, incidentally, this is historical data. It's going to get worse. Not to be an alarmist, but we know that things are getting worse every year. So from the data that we have, unless things change drastically, this is an optimistic picture, and it's not a future projection. Now, the light blue is also 100-year floodplain data, but that transition between periwinkle and dark blue is where the D.C. levee would go. The levee was recently decertified because we had the same plan to deal with supplementing our levee that New Orleans had to supplement its levee, and that didn't quite work out. So we are rebuilding and upgrading our levee, and that's actually where it's going to go. But if you look, and the reason this map is really useful is because if you look at this map, you'll notice that most of the significant landmarks in the district are actually underwater under this map. Lincoln Memorial, most of the mall, the Jefferson Memorial, almost all of Roosevelt Island, the Smithsonian institutions, especially the castle. The sad thing about the map is that the people who are most impacted by this area being destroyed or being underwater are the tourists who come from out of town. And granted, those of us who live here, who work here, who are natives here, we are invested in the safety and continuity and protection of this area, but this is primarily the part of town that's visited by people who are from out of town. And we depend very strongly on the rest of the states to actually take positive action to address climate change so that when they come to visit the district, everything that they come to see will still be here. And again, that's why I love this image, because it helps drive the point home. Okay, so what do we do? Because the district doesn't have any actual power plants within its borders, we use the district's status as an international city to draw attention to both the risks and the measures that we take to offset those risks. There are three things that we go through as far as our energy choices that I wanted to go through, and I wanted to very quickly just say the third point on the PowerPoint should actually be power purchase agreements. So if you have access to the PowerPoint, just change that last one to power purchase agreements. So a reverse auction, the district municipal aggregation program, is authorized by statute, and it allows the district government and pretty much anyone else who wants to buy in to aggregate their purchases for power over multiple years. By statute, the executive branch is already included in this in the district, but we also allow independent agencies, residential consumers, and commercial entities to opt in and participate in MAP. We've been able to save $5.4 million for a 24-month contract and $30 million over 36 months for DC taxpayers alone, not to even include the savings that we've actually been able to afford the private sector. Sustainability pledges have actually been much larger than we initially anticipated and been a very good source of quick wins. Our Sustainable DC program has actually made amazing inroads with other large energy users, particularly those that are not susceptible to government direction in their energy use choices. So embassies, healthcare institutions, universities. In fact, AU, GW, and GW Hospital all recently partnered to sign the nation's non-utility solar purchase agreement. And we're proud to have such responsible partners in our efforts to preserve the environment. The district also aggressively pursues power purchase agreements to power our own operations. We've been working on this for a while, but we'll soon sign an agreement to buy more than 40 megawatts of new wind and more than 10 megawatts of solar on public building rooftops. These projects alone will cut more than 135,000 tons of CO2 per year. That's more than half of the district government's emissions, and it'll significantly reduce our long-term energy costs. Intergovernmental teamwork is probably the most underrated but most vital ingredient for success in our approach. And I'm here speaking on behalf of my agency, but we have been able to partner with not just our other district government agencies, but federal partners, EPA, GSA, most of the entire alphabet soup has actually been really good about being forward-thinking and making sure that they understand that they have a disproportionate impact on the District of Columbia. So they're very good about experimenting as far as trying out solar, buying energy from alternative non-polluting sources. And as far as driving efficiency, our Department of General Services undertook an ambitious plan to reduce district energy use 20% in 20 months, and it was a very successful plan. Now we're just trying to figure out how to build on that and try to reach the 50% goal that we set in the Sustainable DC plan. I have sort of put together a good cheat list of local legislation and regulations that affect local energy use. I can run through them very quickly, but I think it actually, so since I only have 2 minutes, I'm going to skip that. And if anybody has questions, feel free to ask. Okay, so now to tie it back into the proposed rule. The district is providing examples on how jurisdictions can implement policies in building blocks 3 and 4, which would be to use more zero and low emitting power sources and to use electricity more efficiently. Now, some of you may not know this, but the district has had an RPS for nearly a decade. So when we start talking about increased end-use efficiency, it's going to be driven by a few things. but primarily the most recent revision to the district building codes. And we've been sort of calling them the green codes, because they focus mostly on making sure that buildings are performing at their optimal, not just for heat envelope, but also for actual energy use within that building. Now, demand-side management programs, we have several participants, but the central actor in that group is something called the District of Columbia Sustainable Energy Utility. And what we've done there is we also made a policy decision that we are going to treat energy savings as a utility in and of itself. We set up a market-based private participant that's actually able to go out and acquire energy savings. We're still trying to figure out a way to get them to bid that energy savings into the supply market, but that's sort of one of our next steps, because once you can actually have savings that you can bid into a market, it actually allows you to monetize those savings. I'm actually going to stop here, save the time for questions. If you guys have any questions, feel free to contact me. Thank you.
So in the time remaining, I thought we could get a little bit of a debate going amongst the panel here. And I'll start it off with a framing. I think it was quite telling in talking about judicial review that, you know, we're dealing with the nexus of energy and environmental law, and much of what is being attempted to be done with 111D stretches into aspects of the energy markets, their design, their transactional operations, and so on. And therefore, in some ways, the practical concerns about how 111D might apply and be integrated into the way our energy markets work, both regulated areas of the country where you have vertically integrated investor-owned utilities, wherein what we see now might be well expressed through integrated resource planning, to organized power markets, like where we sit today in PJM, which is the world's largest wholesale power market. Some of these issues we'll certainly see coming up in comments, but I guess my first question to the panel, folks have talked about the way the target has been set in this, and that we have basically a rate-based performance target that's established unit by unit and then rolled up to the state level. But we also have building blocks and others that speak to mass-based systems, and that if we are going to have, say, block 3, block 4, renewable energy, energy efficiency, technologies that functionally create indirect emissions reductions in our power systems, how are we going to handle that crossing of the gate once into the flexibility mechanisms from a rate-based to a mass-based and then back from the flexibility mechanisms from the mass-based to the rate-based? It's an interesting question. Maybe I'll start off with Scott. Scott, has this been something that ELI has been looking at, and where do you see the kind of level of discussion on this to date?
As I mentioned earlier, we're not going to comment on the 111D rulemaking because we don't lobby or litigate. We've got energy companies, environmental groups on our membership and board, and so we don't take positions on the actual guts of the proposals, but we've identified as a really critical issue, and I actually think Anne and Roger might have some thoughts about it too, so I defer to them.
And for the record, I'm asking Scott to comment on, you know, the level of debate, not take a position. Anne,
so I think what you're assuming is that that there's a problem with an allowance-based, a mass-based allowance trading system, and I'm not seeing it. I mean, in fact, I think it helps us get over the issues that you've identified in terms of whether EPA is going beyond its authority and trying to regulate the energy system. I think if the rates that EPA has developed can be translated into mass-based caps and incentives, excuse me for a second.
Yeah, sure.
Incentives can be provided to states to adopt systems by which they trade allowances, then you have an enforceable CO2 reduction, you have a permanent CO2 reduction, you have something you can track. And if a state chooses to achieve its targets by generating allowances from some renewable energy type of development, and the agency has some very clear directive about how you count that. And to the extent that they start from a place that recognizes reductions that have already occurred, I mean, I think that, actually the allowance-based system makes it easier and allows for those other metrics that the states have the ability to use now to count. So,
Roger, you know, from your view, you know, I'll note, you know, REGI throughout its development and currently has pretty thoroughly punted on leakage and punted on the indirect emissions reduction issue. We see the same thing out in AB 32, wherein the debates over grid emissions factor that's being used, and there isn't any real tracing back in the merit order of who backed down and when, and so on. From your perspective in industry, and of folks who have to participate and bid units on a daily basis, do you see issues with how this target will manifest?
Sure, thank you. And three quick things. I mean, first on the question about translating to a mass-based approach, I agree with Ann. I think if if the rule survives judicial scrutiny, I think the way EPA set this up for states to say you can do rate-based or mass-based, that's up to you. You have the flexibility. I don't think that causes an additional legal problem. I think EPA did that right in terms of saying we'll give states the flexibility. I think it's a harder question whether EPA itself could do a mass-based approach directly under the Clean Air Act, but I think that part's relatively non-controversial. I think the second point is on the discussion we're having, though, kind of reinforces one of the points I made in my discussion, which is we're talking about very intense to the core energy issues. We're not talking about, you know, environmental pollution, not denying greenhouse gases as environmental air pollutant, but we're not talking about what we typically talk about when we talk about environmental air pollution. What's the technology we can put on a smokestack to control that to address lead or ozone in an area? And I think it reinforces the point that this is fundamentally an energy regulation. And then I think to your question about what we're seeing on this is, I'm sorry, could you remind me? On leakage, thank you. I'm glad you raised leakage because leakage both Ann and I talked about how greenhouse gases are global in their nature. I gave the example of California. If you shut the lights off in California, California still has climate change. Ann had a different view. Ann's view was if you address climate change, greenhouse gas emissions in Texas, that'll solve the problem in Rhode Island to some extent. And so we're saying two different things, and the reason for that is we're treating leakage differently. Leakage is the notion that if we increase the regulations in one place, say we increase greenhouse gas regulations in the United States, will those emissions then just leak to China? Will those companies then relocate hypothetically to China, where in China there's 8 times the amount of greenhouse gases emitted to produce the same dollar of GDP, and you end up exacerbating the issue? To me, leakage is the fundamental flaw in kind of a unilateral climate change policy. I understand the symbolic reasons for an individual state, an individual country wanting to take action on climate change, but until we have a global way of addressing leakage, I think these efforts are going to be more symbolic than having, you know, true environmental outcome, because there's always going to be some other place in the world that's going to pick up that slack and perhaps even exacerbate the problem. That's why I said at the beginning, I was on this climate change justice and human rights task force, where we recognized that the world needs to take action to address climate change using human rights foundations, but do so more globally because of the leakage concerns.
Well, and maybe a point on the historic perspective and how long we might have been digging the hole versus other folks. go ahead.
Real quickly, I would just say that leakage disappears to a certain extent when you have a national system, and I just want to prove that I did the reading for this class by noting that one of the articles, unfortunately I can't remember which one, talked about parallel action coming out of, antitrust law. And that really does serve as the paradigm here in the sense that if the EPA and the United States government takes an action that matters to our global partners, if we keep playing a game of chicken, D.C. is going to look like Kareem's map.
Okay, great. I was going to jump in and make essentially the same point. It's a chicken and egg problem.
that there's, you need a globally coordinated solution, but you're never going to have one unless particular individual countries take the lead and demonstrate that they're willing to make change and take the lead. And so you can't have one without the other. With respect to the mass versus the emissions rate issue, that is something that, in terms of level of discussion, very high level of discussion, lots and lots of comments, lots and lots of questions, and I think possibly very soon EPA will be able to say some more about that and to solicit further input on some further ideas about the conversion of to mass based standard and how that would work. So I mean, it's, you know, we've had an unbelievable amount of input and a lot of input on that issue, and we're not only listening but actively working through what we're hearing. You know, there are lots of things I wanted to say in response to Roger. But I want to start by just sort of recognizing that it's really great to be part of an environmental law community, an environmental law bar where people are extremely thoughtful about comments that they make and issues that they raise, and having fora like this is incredibly important, and when ELI brings people together, it's incredibly important, and Roger raises a lot of good points and interesting points, and that's why we're doing all this public engagement, and that's why we have a proposal out, and we're going to have the opportunity to work through a lot of these issues before we put out the final. So, and of course, to Anne as well, to thank all of them for being so active and so thoughtful in providing all of this input. I guess one question I would ask, though, is whether is it so unprecedented, and is it such a shocker to think that there's a nexus between energy and environmental protection? And you know, it's not, you know, is it really EPA for the first time suggesting that that, you know, for example, energy efficiency and reducing demand is an effective and cost-effective way to reduce the amount of emissions that are coming from power plants, or is that something that's already reflected in the programs, policies, activities that are already out there, you know, in the many states? There's also other places in the Clean Air Act where I think Congress recognizes that connection, like under the acid rain program. I mean, there's some provisions that acknowledge the connection between energy efficiency and renewables and reduction of air pollution. Another point, last point I'll make on that is that you know, power plants themselves or the electric industry itself does. You know, some of this is within their control, and there are integrated utilities and so forth that make investments in energy efficiency and renewables. And so, you know, this is something that the power sector is already involved in. It's already sort of the nexus is already out there. It's recognized, and EPA, I think, is building on that and reflecting it rather than doing something that's so unprecedented.
Yeah, just to supplement that point, I think what you'll also see is that many of these issues are starting to become not just integrated between environmental and energy, but it also becomes a social justice issue. It also becomes a poverty reduction issue. I think Health and Human Services recognizes it in the way that they structure energy assistance. We're actually allowed to spend, we're required to spend a portion of that money on making sure that the heat envelope of a building is upgraded. So these issues are not, they're not discrete issues. They affect each other, and addressing one can help the other.
I mean, I'd be curious to the degree that the folks on this panel see that the level of the interaction that this rule is driving between power market regulators, ISOs and RTOs, public utility commissions, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, NERC on the safety and certification side, and departments of environmental protection and EPA. I'll just point out that traditionally, whether it's REGI, wherein it's simply manifested in the bid to have a clean dark or a clean spark spread on your bid in the power sector, or whether it was a public utility commission in a regulated market space allowing for a utility to pass through on its fuel rider its cost of emission allowance acquisition for compliance. The key thing about what I just described about how it's come before is that the environmental compliance cost was inputted as a cost into unit operation that was then run through security constrained economic dispatch or merit order economic dispatch in the power markets. And one of the areas where this is fairly unprecedented and where I'm seeing it in my practice, both on the regulatory and transactional side, is an unprecedented integration between how public utility commissions, ISOs and RTOs, and DEPs need to work together. When we talk about Block 2 and changing merit order for economic dispatch, environmental dispatch, excuse me, for environmental performance, that is another round of constraint in how the power system operates that no one's sure if that would run before or after reliability, how it would integrate in, and so on. And so in many ways, especially in our organized power markets, the challenge that this rule presents in integrating these concerns in, especially as brought by Block 2, in my humble opinion, seems fairly substantial. I'd be curious what the group sees.
And on that point, just briefly, it raises another set of questions I don't think any of us really had time to address today. But you know, since we're talking about legal issues, I agree with what Ethan says, that there's always a nexus between energy and environmental pollution in any sector. And I think to the question, the difference here, though, that I see is that this rule is taken that a step further to get into domains that are traditionally reserved to state jurisdiction, both as a matter of the 10th Amendment, which reserves the state's powers, not specifically delegated to Congress, and also under federal laws like the Federal Power Act. And so here I see the tension in EPA kind of crossing that line beyond just kind of the traditional energy environmental nexus into specific domains that up until now, as a matter of cooperative federalism, have been specifically reserved to the states, both explicitly and implicitly under the Constitution and laws. So that's going to be, I think, if we're lining up, what are going to be the interesting legal issues the courts are going to deal with? It's a whole other set of legal issues the states are going to be raising. Some of the states will be raising, at least. That's going to bring some constitutional questions into this as well.
When did the state act? When was the state prompted to act? When was it cooperative federalism? When was it based on what the states can do? And I'll point out this issue made even more fascinating slash maddening by the EPSA decision and where we stand with the potential we'll know by the 16th of December whether FERC seeks a certiorari from the Supreme Court for the D.C. Circuit's EPSA decision on their demand response order. But it's a very interesting time as to how state and federal jurisdiction overlap or don't in the energy and environmental market space.
Just to maybe bring it a little bit more down to a level where we're dealing with things that people deal with every day. So Texas has to think about this, and Texas, of course, has a very certain political perspective on the Obama administration and its climate actions, which has been they've not been shy about. So they are now faced with what do they do with this rule? And they also, interestingly, are mostly their own little world in their power sector, and they have their own grid, ERCOT. So if they decide not to play ball in this and say we're not going to do this, we're not going to come up with our own 111D plan, we don't think the federal government has the power to do it, we think you're usurping our power, you think you're becoming FERC, or even the state PUC, what do they then face? They have face EPA becoming their regulator, because that's what happens. If the state decides they have authority under the Clean Air Act and they decide not to act, EPA becomes the regulator. They enforce their what would be the equivalent of a federal implementation plan. Well, then Texas sees its energy grid basically under federal control, which I think would cause every Texan to go screaming from the room. So what do you do with that? Not only that, but if you take the fourth building block, and this is a bit of an exaggeration, and let's say that Texas or EPA decides they're going to use energy efficiency in people's homes as a way to make the power plant comply. So in other words, a power plant's got to make sure people use less energy in their homes. And again, this is a far-reaching example. Does that mean that if the power plant doesn't comply, EPA somehow has to get into that chain and go back into people's homes to talk about compliance? That's a law school kind of example. That's not going to happen. But those are the kind of legal issues we're talking about, constitutional issues and structural issues, because having EPA work in energy is really key. We're doing seminars on energy law for environmental lawyers because people in our field, the typical environmental folks, don't understand energy law. They don't understand 75% of what you just said. And it's important for people to be able to do that. So it's really critical. It also shows a huge flaw in our laws. Why don't our laws address that? You guys are the SDLP. This is not a sustainable law. Having EPA over here, FERC over here, the states in the middle, is a terrible way to run things. So once again, we need to get back to that.
Yeah. I'm going to get back to Texas for a second and note that it's actually pretty interesting when you look at Texas to discover that they have a huge wind effort going on in Texas. They've done a lot of investment in the transmission system, which is a system that takes the wind energy and directs it around to places where it can be used. And they're the place where carbon capture and sequestration is actually happening. There's several projects that are either ongoing there or thinking of starting there. And we expect to see some retrofit capture bolt-on technology on existing fossil generation in Texas, and the sequestration of the carbon in enhanced oil recovery, which is already ongoing in Texas and has been for 40 years. You take carbon dioxide, you put it down, the oil comes up, the carbon dioxide stays down. So that's the technology that is happening now and has been. So on the one hand, you can talk about Texas being politically motivated not to want to have the EPA ruling its energy system or its environmental regulation. On the other hand, this rule may create some incentives for Texas to want to play because it can get some credit for stuff it's already doing.
Interesting as to, you know, what type of linkages between the states have to be ultimately established to allow for arbitrage of environmental commodities amongst them in compliance with this rule. We're coming close on the end of the time. I'll point out one just kind of fascinating local example that I had heard that shows how all this kind of stuff comes together. A year or two back, I was serving on the region's Council of Governments Energy and Environmental Committee, and we had this presentation about a weather event that had happened in the district wherein we had substantial loss of power. I think many of you might remember this. What was fascinating is people saying that as the grid cascaded and went down within D.C., because we did not have critical circuit protection in a lot of the infrastructures, the pumping station that the folks who control the sewers, the pumping stations that basically take the rainwater that in much of D.C. mixes with the sewer water and brings it out of the city, began to go down one by one. Much of the backup generators, as we found time and time again with diesel generators, failed to restart. We've had instances last winter where up to 50% of the diesel backup gens did not start. But in this one instance in D.C., what was fascinating is they lost all but I think it was either one or two pumping stations. I think there was one or two pumping stations that were left up going. And the protocol for D.C., if that station had gone down, and it was close, one more had gone down, was to evacuate all of downtown. And for those of you who are from here, like I am, I'm a native Washingtonian, there's one thing that I can absolutely guarantee you, and that is we are horrible in this town at getting a lot of people out of it in the same time period. Absolutely horrible. And so it's an example of how increased weather effects, needs for adaptation, the way our environmental controls and the way our energy markets come together. Those pumping stations, if they could be hardened into microgrids that could island themselves in the future, could provide a whole bunch of added reliability value to the city if our power markets evolve to compensate them for the services that they provide, these distribution level assets. We could see a sea change, and that is kind of the two other mega trends that's worth noting here in the context of the climate discussion, is that in the power sector, we have natural gas prices at historic lows, and we have a rise of distribution level assets, solar storage, geothermal, energy efficiency. We have the rise of utilities like the Sustainable Energy Utility and others who have begun to look at, on a kilowatt hour basis, what's the most efficient energy source. And as we go into a future where it's going to matter less about where you sit in the system, but whether you can perform the service and compete with the other people who are performing that service, we're going to see a lot of solutions that we don't see now rising up. And I think one of the things that EPA did with the blocks is to try to give as much flexibility as they can. And in many ways, the flexible spirit that we saw originally with the CDM and JI and parts under the flexibility mechanisms to Kyoto, experience at the Clean Air Markets Division, CIPCOL, so on, that we've had. And, you know, now what's fascinating is that much of what we saw on the undercurrents of the clean energy standard debates nationally and so on, and that flexibility, that cooperative federalism, give the states a mandate but let them meet it in a way that matches their resource base. That's what we're seeing a lot happening now. So with that, let's give a hand to our great panel here.